to the next episode of Embracing Your Mortality with me, Sue Brain. Over the winter, I've been talking to some amazing people. A couple turning John Lennon's Gypsy Caravan into a story space for children.
We call it a forensic restoration. It's an extraordinary undertaking. If a nail can be preserved, he's preserving it.
A world-renowned crop circle researcher, lecturer and artist.
They've been reported now in over 60 different countries. The UK is the epicentre for it, there's no doubt about it.
And an author whose book about her mother's Alzheimer's is being turned into an audio play starring Juliet Stevenson.
She said, "I'm confused when I can't remember, but I know my thoughts are clear."
I'm particularly delighted to welcome Chloe Goodchild, who I first met over 20 years ago. Chloe is an international singer, composer, educator, author, and founder of The Naked Voice, which he teaches around the world and uses it to promote peace, healing, and non-violent communication.
I think for us all, you know, whatever it is that we're called to in this life, whether we're aware of it being a calling or not. And so for me, the first wake-up call was being partially deaf as a child. And I had traumatic surgery on my ears about the age of 4, so was not able to hear very well for about 3 years. I could hear in kind of muffled way, just sort of semi-hearing, but my auditory consciousness basically turned inwards. And so I was really compelled to feel nature and to discover the sentience of nature, if you like, as a child, without the sound of it. You know, the water, the wind. But it wasn't really till I was about 7 that I started, as the normal hearing started coming back again, that I was able to start hearing and responding to music and sound in its outer expression just became my great passion and love. You know, and it translated itself into and through music, because music seemed to be the closest language that I could find. Music as in instrumental music and choral music. That's really where I started to discover the field, sound as a field of energy.
With your school chums or the peer group, what, did they think you were weird, or did you hide it, or were you open about it?
I mean, you know, I just was always asking questions, you know, and I think I'm grateful to that early, quite dramatic experience for that, because I wanted to know, you know, why am I here? Who am I? What's going on here? And at school, why am I being taught everything but what I want to know? So music saved my life because it did respond to those questions.
Helped you feel safe and stable.
Very much so, because I could feel the vibration of my in my skin, my body, you know, I could feel myself alive. And obviously, because my dad was a priest, and so I had that whole Christian logos running through every week of my life. And that, even though it was the institutionalized version of Christianity, nevertheless, I'm really grateful for that. So I got really fascinated by Christ's journey. And then, of course, the music of Bach and the Matthew Passions, the John Passions, you know, and the really spelling out this extraordinary journey of this man, you know, who basically was able to demonstrate and embody the most extraordinary things I'd ever seen, like any of us had ever seen, you know.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, was still able to say, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do."
What a journey, eh?
Just being with you, it's also reminding me of your extraordinary work. So it's a great privilege to be talking to you about one of my most favorite subjects and areas. I was actually once singing with a woman. She was going to die quite soon. So we were in this hospice, and there was a chant that we used to sing, Om Anandamayi Chaitanyamayi, and it was a chant to the Great Mother, and she absolutely loved this chant. So we started singing it, and she taught me so much. It was just so, but it was almost like the amusing side of the whole process of leaving or not. So she literally, we would be singing and she'd be going, wow, you know, it's so beautiful.
She was seeing the other world.
Yeah, just literally seeing the other world. And then suddenly her mind would come in and she'd go, oh, but there's just one thing I've forgotten, and the whole thing would come to It was a great teaching for me because it really demonstrated to me, you know, what we're doing a lot of the time, which is, you know, we're learning to just kind of completely surrender ourselves to the present moment, for you know, and suddenly, you know, some kind of crazed thought comes in, or some fear or some sense of separateness comes in.
And also, I think that really beautifully demonstrates that there is for a lot of people, there is a conscious process of preparing to die.
Right.
With one foot in one world and one foot in still in the human physical realm. And I find that fascinating. We talked before how your singing and using the voice is about breath, and breath is about consciousness, and consciousness is about accepting our mortality. And I just wanted you to say a little bit more about that.
It's such a tender question, and it's one that I would say probably I learned best from my dad, because I was actually with him as he passed. He really demonstrated to me that he had really completed his life on this planet and this time around. He'd always wanted me to make a sung version of the Lord's Prayer. And so I just started singing. It was very clear that he had Cheney Stokes breathing, and it was very clear that he was ready to go, but he really put his all into this singing, and he really attempted, and so beautifully, and we sang together. He was just like completely enraptured, you know, and he was really seeing the beyond. It was not long after that, the whole family was now in and around his bed and everything. And everything suddenly calmed down, and it's as if the Cheney Stokes breathing somehow miraculously disappeared. I don't know whether that's a common thing. Mm. His eyes were very clear, and he just was concentrating just on looking out beyond. And he took a deep breath, and we all just went, we got mesmerized, and just, and then he took another breath. And it was like rebirthing, you know, of another kind. He took another breath. And we were all just doing it with him, you know. And then the third breath he took, and he just took a big breath in. And he just closed his mouth. Gone.
Yeah, gone. And do you know what's so amazing? When they're gone, they're gone.
Right.
Aren't they? Just, there's an empty envelope on the bed.
Yes. Who was that? You know.
Gone.
Yes, yes. Yes.
I find that journey, that closing of the book, utterly incredible. When we sit with the dying, in my understanding of it, they teach us there's something more. And some people believe that's it. Talking to so many people about the whole concept of the actual dying process, I'm absolutely convinced something happens after death.
What I got with my dad was that it's as if he just sort of, the field of his being just kind of expanded into the room, very much aware of his a presence that was so peaceful. I always remember Ram Dass saying that when somebody dies, you just say to them, it's perfectly safe.
When my dad died, I just opened the windows and said, fly, Dad, fly. He was a pilot during the Second World War, but he'd never really flown in his life. There was something about him that was quite Saturnian in nature. And I just thought, that's what you need to do. Just fly wherever you need to fly. And it was so exciting opening the windows for him and just, bye.
And just for us, so coming back to the breath and the voice, and how does that assist this process? You know, very much from a very early stage of developing this work that we call the naked voice, I've always experienced it and practiced it as every breath you take is that breath is a practice for leaving this physical form and just transiting into the wider field of who one is. You know, oneself is all there is. I think that brings with it for people an incredible sense of awe, but the flip side of awe or wonder is fear, you know. And we're seeing that, of course, writ large in the world at the moment. So with our work, we're very interested in the language of when you actually ask a person, what does fear sound like? They go, well, I couldn't possibly sing that because I'm not a musician and I can't sing it. Once you go through the story, they just start accessing the sound of fear. So very often I use a question like, how do you feel and how does that sound? So a lot of people at the moment are saying, I feel very frightened about what's going on in the world. So you then go, well, how does that sound? And the sound will be very primal. It will be very kind of rajasic, as they say in India, like very animated. But what you realize that is that it is just energy once you start listening to it. It's the emotion that is the messenger of an energy that is what we describe as a wisdom, actually, that's in every individual, that is older and deeper than the polarity of all conflict. And it just comes back to this incredible, and that's an in-breath, actually.
Yes, it's actually taking life back in again.
So a lot of people over the course of time have taught me that fear is just the flip side of wonder or awe. You're allowed to experience wonder and awe in childhood, or maybe if you're lucky, you have the right conducive environment as you're growing up, or you start seeking it out.
The messages I got about awe, it was totally inappropriate.
Really?
It was not appropriate to feel in awe or wonder unless it was actually addressed specifically to do with something to do with the church. And I think what you're doing is allowing people to meet their awe and wonder with utter expression of
love,
beyond who they believe they are. And that's what this is all about, isn't it?
Absolutely that. And of course, as you're implying, you're transmitting is that understanding also of no judgment. So very often we will say, how do you feel? How does that sound? But then most important, what quality of silence does your voice leave behind? And so then that's something very interesting that can happen there, because suddenly you're not thinking about your voice and is it going to be good and this is scary, or all those narratives kicking in around how one was thrown out of the choir or whatever it was. All of that disappears because your attention actually is on that silence.
Yeah, I want to talk to you more about silence, because so many people are terrified of silence. And I think a lot of people interpret dying in as silent, and of course it isn't, it's anything but silent, and death as silent, in my understanding, it's anything but silent.
Well, it's really interesting, actually, because I'm just about to run a course, actually, in this year on the whole theme of silence. It's the first time I've done it, and for many of us, silence is about being silenced.
Punished.
Yeah, so it's a passive experience, it's a suppressing experience, it's an oppressive experience, you know. It's something where we are made smaller, we are constricted, we are confined, we are told what not to do, what we can and cannot do. That has its own music, you know, and the voice is a way of accessing the whole range of human emotion that accompanies that. And so once you start unpacking that, you realize that there is an antidote to that silence with a small s, to silence, to be, and instead of being silenced, you are being silence. That is a very, very different experience, because suddenly you're at home in yourself. You know, it's like when you fall in love, there's no need to even say anything anymore. It's just amazing, you know. It's just like, wow.
It's so sad that our society, that we've lost those ancient wisdoms and crucibles of silence that held us in awe of God, or whatever you want to say. And the fact retreat was just a natural part. The soul needs retreat to replenish and to make sense of things and to sit in silence and in awe and wonder. And I'm so sad that we've lost it, but it's so wonderful that you are doing the work that you're doing to enable people to reconnect with the sacredness of silence, actually. I think that's what we're talking about, isn't it?
That's so beautiful. And in fact, you're reminding me now of how, when I first happened upon this kind of alchemy between sound and silence and the voice as it arises out of silence, when it's what we call the naked voice or the authentic voice, or when you're giving voice to truth, it's coming from a depth of loving presence within you, you know, where there's no right or wrong doing anymore. Mm. There's just this awareness of, this is who I am, and this is the messenger of who I am. When I was at Cambridge in studying there, that's when I first came across the Quakers. And it was so amazing, having been in this very busy, institutionalized church system, you know, with its highlights, albeit, but a lot of kind of dogma and action and reason and, you know, too much sound, to find myself in a completely silent place where everybody just sat in silence for an hour. And then there was this concept of, if you want to give ministry, anybody can do that. It doesn't have to be some special priest or priestess. I was so fascinated by this. And I remember when I came to Bristol and came to Redland meeting in the late 70s. And I started having some very dramatic dreams at that time. And it was just when I was starting to learn Indian vocal music and studying this extraordinary relationship between the unchanging ground, the unchanging note of that, what we call do, or the home note. That note, which might be, in this case, it might be A, and how being in India, you know, and learning this Indian way of singing where you don't have to go anywhere, that one note stays, never changes, and then you just sing out of there. And so it was like this silence was like that unchanging note. And I'd had this dream about a group of us climbing up this mountain, and we were all standing around this crater lake. We all were looking down into the depths of this mountain, crater lake, and it was like this water was gushing up from very deep below. And everybody, I remember in the dream looking round and seeing everybody was spitting into it as if they were trying to join what little life they had.
Wow. With this
mighty life force that was coming. And I just thought, wow, is that what's going on here? So I just started thinking, almost a sense that I had a responsibility to start giving voice to my own version of that, whatever that might be. I was so lucky to have that experience, because sound started coming out of the mouth, like non-verbal sound. You know, very, very simple. And, you know, for its own sake.
Yes.
It's just not like doing it to impress anyone, not entertaining, just finding the bridge between myself, who I am sitting here in this silent meeting house, discovering that the unfettered naked voice itself, non-verbal voice, really bridges my soul with the soul of this community. It was a wonderful opportunity, and I'm forever blessed by that.
I think you work a lot with conflict resolution, don't you, or using the voice within that?
Really, as soon as we're communicating, there's a chance that we may be communicating from a place of duality, from the egoic mind, In which case it's kind of, excuse me, do you realize who I am? I'm clearly, you know, have the final word on this. And, you know, I know I'm right. You know, it's either that or no one ever listened to me, you know, and so I'm going to really make sure that I'm heard. Yeah. Each of us has a whole kind of spectrum of egoic voices, you know, arise from the narrative of our childhoods and our whole biological life, right? My experience of conflict resolution was very much assisted by living in a very large family. So I had three sisters and one brother. That'll do it right there.
Yeah, that'll do it. Yeah,
that'll do it right there. So there you have the drama of that particular family. And slowly but surely over the course of time, I realized what was happening was I was leaving my body a lot in order to cope with how to navigate the dynamics of this family life that was basically really dealing with the spirit, what I called the spirit body split. That challenge for my dear parents, who I love very dearly, they were delivering, you know, a kind of institutionalized spirit, Christianity, which was very much a denial of the body, you know, and they were doing their best. That was their values, you know, and it had some really awesome points to it, and it had some really downside to it. That kind of biological narrative follows you out of the family into the world. So how that kind of started translating itself for me personally was I thought, right, we've got to sort this out. This cannot be right. You know, the body and the spirit have to be one thing. Surely they have to be on there. I'm actually grateful to that narrative because it forced me, it compelled me, it inspired me, it required me to really start investigating how can we actually, you know, navigate the conflicts that come up against in our everyday lives, personally, professionally, you know, and in the wider field. And for me, it was feminism in the early 80s. And because of the Quakers, thanks to them, I was introduced to the work of nonviolence of Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi. And I started careering around the countryside with the Quaker Peace Action Caravan, you know, and they started inspiring in me this idea of, you know, being able to dramatize conflict and then the resolution of it. And then, of course, we have the CND movement. And long story short, I was then found myself climbing up the Greenham Common fences, lying down in front of army tanks. And you start discovering quite a lot more about conflict by doing that. It wasn't really till I came back to the music that I had loved so much and realized there's got to be something about music that can help me with this. Mm-hmm. And even in Cambridge, even though I sang in all these incredible choirs, I was going up and out of the body the whole time. It was all this beautiful, angelic music. So I had to go off to Africa to connect my body again with, you know, coherent village communities for where sound and singing was still into
and dance as well. They dance and their pelvises.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I love that.
Oh, absolutely. The dance of the jumping goat. That was the first one that I was introduced to. It was amazing. And they literally danced around me. You know, we can see you need this.
I'm really curious about this mind-body split. A lot, if not the majority of people in Western cultures, just live in their head because it's easier than being in the body. We don't know how to welcome our spirit and actually work in tandem with the spirit as the main creative force.
It's so true. Everything you're saying is so true because, as you say, we've been brought up in this kind of culture that is so driven by the left side of the brain, the academic mind, the intellect, you know, and it's only recently, by the grace of God, with the evolution of science from Newtonian and Darwinian science to quantum science, that we now know that we're all interconnected and the head and the body can get back together again, you know.
But how do you do that when you don't know how to? And I guess that's where the voice comes in.
You got it. You've absolutely got it. Going to the Sufi tradition, for example, where I was very blessed to discover the work of Hazrat Inayat Khan. He was this extraordinary player of the veena, which is one of the most ancient instruments of India. And it, if you hear this sound, I mean, you just put it on and everything comes back together. It's the most primordial sound you've ever heard. It's like a really bass sitar. It was the discovery of Indian, the Indian voice, the indigenous community life in Africa, in North America, in British Columbia, in the Middle East, and started just really sitting in these communities and started to feel, but you know, just really how sound is the most profound source of consciousness. And it's the messenger, it's the conduit and the compass of the human spirit.
I had an extraordinary experience not so long ago in a teepee. And it was a sacred fire ceremony. And the women, there was 24 of us, and the women were singing their soul song. And I realized I have never had a soul song. And it was such a shock and a waking up going, well, why don't I have my own soul song?
Sometimes we think we have an idea that that soul song has to sound a certain way. It has to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Music is all we are, right? We call it speaking, and then we separate it from singing. But it's all soul sound, remembered or forgotten, heard or unheard.
I mean, what's your vision now, Chloe, for the work that you're doing? Where do you want this to go now?
I feel like where I want it to go, it has gone. It's happening thanks to COVID, bizarrely enough. Because I suddenly could not teach in public, in person, with people, running groups, I was invited by different partnerships that I didn't even really, wasn't aware of these partnerships existing until that moment. They came in and they just said, would you like to teach online with us? And this is what started happening. And so suddenly, instead of working with 30 people or 50 people or one person, I'm working with 650 people or more, you know. And suddenly, there was a gig the other night with the HeartMath people, Global Coherence Pulse. Over 1,000 people showed up.
Wow.
From all different parts of the globe. The Aborigines talk about sounding a new world into being. I now know that is happening. We're really, as a humanity, being taught something profound here. We mustn't miss it, you know, that we are transforming this dark crown of unconsciousness that has been driving the human race for a very long time into, we're restoring the golden crown of consciousness.
That was the wonderfully inspiring Chloe Goodchild. For more information about Chloe and her workshops, please go to chloegoodchild.com. My next guest is Megan Kelly, a highly experienced family constellation facilitator who is passionate about helping people to heal their ancestral wounds.
What we're doing in a constellation is looking for the origin of a problem. Comes from the belief that any problem we have today stems from the family system.
If you haven't already, don't forget to listen to the first 3 series of Embracing Your Mortality. Links to all my guests in all the series can be found on my website, suebrain.co.uk. In the meantime, here's to living more consciously for a better world.
The Embracing Your Mortality podcast was researched and recorded by Sue Brain and produced and edited by The Podcast Den.